Folks, we have to get started now. Please sit back down.
I don't know. Could you hear it?
Okay, we're going to get started again. Please hold your conversations until lunch. Okay, we're going to be focused on the second track. Yeah, that'll be Mills Davis and Mike Bennett. I would say come up front. And folks on the phone, we're going to get started again. Track two, case studies.
Hi, I'm Mills Davis, Mike Bennett. We're going to talk for a half an hour about the work that went on in track two, which is about case examples. I use the word case examples rather than studies because a lot of ours are much more at the precy level than they are in the, you know, get down, get dirty. But relative to the framework discussion we had, you know, a lot of the ideas that are in the framework are exemplified. And as I said, they're exemplified in it in combinations. Is it just a click on this guy?
Down arrow.
Yeah, there he goes. This one is worth a zoom.
F11.
F11.
And then Control L.
There we go.
Also, that window isn't even full.
Well, do you want to pull it up?
Go to the click on that thing just to make it.
This here?
Yeah. That makes it a little bigger.
Okay. And then he says F11.
F11.
And then.
Oh.
Does it work? Maybe there's a limit here.
Go to view.
There's a menu option. Yeah,
go to view up left and then full screen down the bottom. There you go. At least that makes it bigger.
Okay, well, this is semi-better. So those of you that can bring up the slides on your own, you know, you're probably better off. My purpose isn't to read all this, but to set a context, and then I'm going to turn over to Mike, and he's going to talk about, you know, some of the themes that came out of the different cases. And also, at the very end of the slide deck, we've got precis of 20 or so case examples that were discussed through track two, but I also included some of the, you know, the global challenges. So there are a couple different things that I'd like to have set. The bias I brought to this, which I promised you I'd share, is that I look at this more from the standpoint of, like, what's in the market, what's growing, what's getting traction. And the spectrum I see, you know, with all things, with ontology, with knowledge, and so on, the joke can always be made, it's like going west, because there's always further to go. But the exciting stuff over the last few years, for me anyway, has been to see that, you know, there are actually areas that are emerging, you know, which I would call low-hanging fruit. That is, there are certain classes of problems where, you know, there are proven benefits. These are combinations. They're not single use case kind of things. It's sort of like empowering subject matter users to all connect their information together without having to go to IT to get something built, et cetera, that type of thing. But benefits, low risk, real value. And the second part of it is, what are some of the other, you know, dimensions of, you know, the ontology story? Is this risky? You know, is my business going to collapse? Does this stuff really work? Is it easy to use? Do I have to train everybody? So here we're talking about, you know, there also exist off-the-shelf tools, solutions that can be used by, in this case, you know, subject matter experts or business users, or in the case of Siri, in a consumer sense, it can be used by anybody. Basic, you know, takeaway from that is that the companies that are, like, focusing on this are focusing on whole solutions for some particular set of problems or sector or segment of the market, and they're not necessarily the most deep or complex. Some are, but the right solutions, the right problems, you know, generate real value. And so we've tried to illustrate a few of those. For example, dealing with, you know, combining information from spreadsheets and databases, or another one had to do with do-it-yourself, you know, to find your agents to go out and monitor the web, and, an example there was with Connotate, some others like that. Okay, sort of the second grouping for me were, I sort of said, my God, ontology-based applications are coming into the mainstream, and we're actually seeing people. Mike Ushold said, you know, the phone rings, you know, like, you know, it's like there was a time when the phone didn't ring and the eyes glazed over, but, you know, but now actually people are coming and sort of saying, you know, I think there's a problem here that I can't get to. I've got all of these different databases and, you know, I can't build a warehouse, or I got all these different things, you know, I need a kind of an information web, and there seems to be this emerging technology. Even in the library and people that have, you know, assets, they start saying, you know, I've always been serious about organizing my information and making it accessible and secure, but gee, if the semantic stuff could work, then there might be a little bit easier to connect my information with the other guy's information. So you see a bunch of things like this. And again, case examples exist. There are multiple providers of technologies and services. That's another de-risker for people, you know, like I don't have just, you know, what happens if that guy goes away? And then there were three or four kind of areas where you were sort of seeing it, you know, the discovery, connecting, integrating, interpreting information of different kinds, aggregating and connecting and orchestrating services, like the Siri example gives you that one, modeling and automating decision rules and decision-making process, like BeInform, a methodology that realize value from different stages of the solution lifecycle. What we're seeing as a trend now is to take areas of knowledge work that have methodologies about them and move from kind of a document-centric to a knowledge-centric kind of work process for knowledge work. Which allows you to harvest and leverage, for example, the deep traceability of requirements across a life cycle of a project, or the ability to, if I model it first, then I can generate things, or if I model it, I can simulate off of it. And this is starting to sink in, and we're starting to see it. There's a retooling of our first generation, you know, word processor, spreadsheet. I mean, to make these things like semantically aware, yeah, I think these things will come this decade. And finally, you know, they're cutting edge opportunities. They're tough problems, grand challenges. A lot of times, these are things that blow off. You know, you can't do this with IT, or you did it once and you already knew you blew, you know, lots of money on this one. And so we've had some discussions on that, and they're, you know, grand challenges and so on. But also there are sets of problems, the results of which, for example, as we move into the mobile era, you know, the internet as we knew it, you know, has to change because, you know, all the issues of services have to self-configure based on where I'm at, you know, and so that involves knowing, you know, being able to know things, not have something that was fixed back when we wrote the code, but something that kind of can interpret on the fly and can scale. Similarly, we have, you know, the scale of information and the dynamics of what's changed. All the problems that, you know, were so deeply investigated in the intelligence communities. Every business of any side needs foresight, has to deal with lots of information. So the big data analytics also have semantic dimensions that are very important, especially if you can put them in the hands of subject matter expertise as opposed to somebody who does statistical algorithms only. So anyway, so those are my kind of opening frameworks. The basic other distinction I make is that the value propositions are framed quite differently depending on who, you know, kind of which person you're talking to, first, second, third, or fourth person. If it's for me and mine, you know, it's my personal empowerment, it's what enjoyment I'm getting, it's, you know, capabilities it gives me. If it's the we side of things, second person, it has to do about the language we have in common, the information we can share, the process we can collaborate, the cooperation that we can deal with. And so these knowledge and collaborative kind of things, and we see ontologies being used there. And the third person, it has to do with the kinds of things we're talking about with enterprises or design of product feature sets and so on. And in the fourth person, it's the systemic, the ecosystems and so on. And each of these have different kinds of themes when we start to do the value proposition about why I want to use ontology. At this point, let me turn it over to Mike.
Thanks, Mills. Let's bring that down there. So I'm Mike Bennett, and I was working with Mills on the on this track. So what I've tried to do is, you know, when we, the aim of this summit is to be able to make the case for ontologies. So, you know, when we started looking at what that involves, it became clear that there are lots of different things people mean when we say, oh, I've got an ontology for this or ontology for that. You know, to one person it might be a, you know, a decidable, searchable, OWL type of resource, and to another person it might be a business conceptual model of the knowledge within a business domain. And in fact, we can boil the case down to essentially a couple of things. Ontologies are everywhere anyway. You know, your IT resources, your databases, you know, whenever somebody sat down and created some kind of code or data model, they had an idea in their head about the meanings of those things. And as long as that thing only ever did the one job it was designed to do, that was fine. Once we start integrating, once we start trying to get information that's reusable across different applications or different businesses or across a supply chain, meaning suddenly becomes important. And in fact, a lot of business people have been independently using the word semantics without ever having heard of ontologies or the semantic web or any of that stuff. So there's that whole side of things on what I would call, to give it its technical name, the business conceptual model, a model of the problem domain. Now, having identified how ontologies can be used for that, then there's a lot more interesting things you can do with it. So if you've got a formal model of your reality, guess what? Here are lots of other value-add things we can do. So in our case studies, we started by looking at the framework that Track 1 put together, which tries to, I'll come back to that slide, that tries to kind of set out the different dimensions of these applications so that we weren't just talking about what one person thinks everybody means by ontology or what another person thinks everybody means by ontology. So we looked at selecting case studies across these different kinds of application so as to be able to tease out the benefits and the kind of audience and the case we need to make for those kind of things. So it's hard to do justice to a whole set of case studies in one quick presentation. So I'm just going to try and give you a few kind of pointers to find your way around. So on the wiki itself, we've got a list of the case studies. In fact, there's two lists now. There's like a summary list of the main important ones, including, as Mills says, a couple of the grand challenges and things added. And then below that, we've harvested from each individual presentation that people gave us. We asked them to tell us what was the problem you were solving, what's the main features of your architecture, in other words, the solution, and what were the business benefits and so on. So you'll see for each of these in this table, for example, you can stroll down through the wiki and find that kind of summarization of each of those and then click on through to the slides themselves from those presenters. So what I'm going to try and do is, without kind of going through each of these, just try and give you a feel for how we've kind of try to cover the whole spectrum from having a business conceptual model for an industry to use to compare knowledge through to how different people have been harvesting information within those or getting analyzing documentation and putting information into an ontology through to doing, you know, quite smart searchable things for dynamic configuration of products such as car rental or truck manufacturer and things like that. So we've got, I think, the whole spectrum of kinds of ontology. So just quickly click on to the next. So as I mentioned, the framework, we just went through that in track one, so I'm not going to go through it in detail. But we tried to identify the different dimensions of what an ontology is, so what it does, what the architecture was, the who, what, when, and how. And then try to classify the use cases, integration, decision support, and so on. I think here we've got a little bit of work to do on the classification. So there's integration at runtime is one kind of integration, and then there's the old-fashioned problem of integration that people have been having to do for years, where you get two systems, you have to bring them together. And an ontology is actually very helpful in that instead of people having to do lots of many-to-many mapping between different lists of terms with the meanings in their heads, we actually have the meaning out there in a semantic model. Then you've got, you know, decision support. We've got a lot of strong case studies on things like help desk type of applications where having a semantically enabled system with an ontology behind it has enabled people to solve people's problems faster over the phone and stuff. A lot of stuff on semantic augmentation for various functions that people carry out in their day-to-day jobs, and applications in knowledge management, gathering domain knowledge from people. And incidentally, there's a kind of circularity here that if you think of knowledge management as being presenting a draft ontology of terms and definitions and relationships to your subject matter experts to actually gather their knowledge in a form that they can understand. So you have an ontology of business terms as the business owns it, which is knowledge discovery. Well, then that's the thing you can use for integration between systems. So there's kind of a connection between some of these knowledge management cases and the integration case there. So that might be something to tease out. Just to summarize the kind of case studies we've got case studies from right across financial services. We've got a couple of things there, vehicle rental, pharmaceuticals, telecoms, manufacturing, also legal stuff, the classic kind of intelligence and security applications, other government things. And interestingly, technology development itself, the use of ontology to define concepts about the development process itself. That was an interesting one that I'd never previously thought of. So there's quite a range there of industry sectors that we've gathered case studies from. And in looking through these, I've pulled out the basic use cases, or to put it in English, the basic problem that people were trying to solve that a given case study pointed to. So we've got knowledge management. You know, there's quite a few case studies that were really either using or extracting knowledge, going through unstructured documents and extracting knowledge from them, and all that classic knowledge management use case. So the knowledge extraction and search is kind of a part of that, really. Some of the case studies, we've got ones on gathering business intelligence through that kind of knowledge extraction. We've got the classic, threat detection, finding out about from traffic between various unusual people, whether they might pose a threat to someone, that kind of thing. And some good stuff on research and development as well, pharmaceutical knowledge bases and things for R&D. And we also had some good use cases with just old-fashioned business and industrial applications. So, for example, being able to configure a production line to quickly react to the needs for different combinations of components for the example we've got here is for trucks, so that you got greater business agility than you would previously have had, because you can use an ontology to more agilely set up different short production runs with different combinations of parts that actually come together into a product. And obviously, that's got huge applicability to things way beyond trucks. A similar one to that, but driven from the customer side, was a vehicle rental application, where there are so many different options to what you can do. Having an ontology behind what the user interacts with to select their particular combination of requirements for their particular vehicle rental requirements means that they can get exactly what they want. They come back to you again, and it's a lot quicker and more efficient for the user as well. And then, as I say, we had use cases of the use of ontologies within the development process itself. So essentially defining semantics of concepts around service-oriented architecture, around linking and traceability of requirements to functional parts of the development and so on. So that's quite an interesting use case. All of the range of examples we've got kind of point into those different business requirements or use cases, as we like to call them. I'm not going to go through this one in detail, but one of the things we were aware of looking at the framework, what are the different kinds of thing that are an ontology, what kinds of technology do people use? When somebody says ontology, they might assume that everybody means an OWL file by it, and somebody else assumes quite the opposite. So what were the actual notations and the actual kinds of tooling that we saw in our case studies. We saw web ontology language, OWL, was used in quite a few places. And of course, that opens up things like semantic querying, a thing called Sparkle, which is the query language that goes with OWL. So we saw a few strong applications that were making use of that kind of classic semantic web technology, and interestingly adding some interesting usability layers around that. We also saw UML used as a tool for modeling ontologies in at least one case. And also we saw something I've been working on, which is an OMG standard called the Ontology Definition Metamodel that lets you take a UML tool and use it to represent OWL constructs. So there are a couple of examples of that, that way of doing things. So you've got the flexibility of that kind of tooling. Then there were also some good examples using Semantic Media Wiki. And again, that generally has, I think, OWL and RDF constructs behind it. There are also a few of the case studies didn't quite tell us exactly what they had under the hood. Just, yeah, you know, there's an ontology and here's what it does, and some very impressive stuff coming out of there. So we saw some good natural language processing and translation and so on. We saw a couple of examples with triple stores that are either proprietary or RDF based. And a few systems making use of formal representation of rules as well as semantics. So as well as the ontology, which is like the logical representation of things and facts, you know, of facts about the world and what is, you had rules based on logic behind that to do a lot of very interesting stuff in helping people to either find the right products or extract knowledge or those kind of things. And we also had some vocabulary-based use cases in there as well. So using ontologies to bring together, for example, different business units that use different words for the same things. You have a semantic model that has, you know, each thing is defined once, each thing and fact, and then you have your vocabularies that have the different words for that. There's a lot of interesting stuff I'm sure we'll be hearing about later on how to bring vocabularies and ontologies together, but we saw at least one case study that was using an ontology to unify different people's vocabularies about the world. Also, it was mentioned in the framework something about what ways things were presented to, for example, users or to business subject matter experts, validation or whatever. So I went back through the case studies and pulled out a quick summary of what kinds of presentation methods people were using to either present or validate ontology material. So you had the classic OWL tools like Protégé and so on that give you a view of an OWL model. You had UML tooling, both in UML and in ontology definition metamodel, to give you a maybe slightly more nuanced way of presenting or extracting stuff from out of those models. There was at least one example with a wiki, a semantic media wiki, which was used to bring things to present information. There's some interesting ones which use like Visio and other kind of graphical notations layered on top of the classic ontology itself to provide a more business consumable view or input or things like that. And a lot of custom interfaces and forms and things like that in some of the case studies that we saw. If you go through them, you'll see some very interesting sets of interfaces and forms and functions and things that allow the ontology to remain out of sight of the user but deliver the value for what that particular application was doing. And then there was also natural language, natural language extraction and things like that in there. I think that covers the... And something I wanted to add, because I think it's an important question, whether it's part of the framework or where we put it, but the theory of what it is that's modeled. So to say, oh, here's an ontology, well, is that being used as a model of the business domain, or is it used as part of a solution to use some kind of semantic searching or some other kind of approach to do something with? So I think it's worth looking back at the case studies and thinking what was actually modeled in that example. So, for example, we have business conceptual models. So, where you have like the EDM Council work, a model of the
problem domain itself, a model of securities, for example. Domain knowledge, you know, research and development type of knowledge, again, very like a conceptual model. It's a model of the world itself rather than of some solution. Then we did have some case studies where what was actually modeled in the ontology was some data model itself. So, and similarly had ontological models of technical development constructs. So these are models, ontologies of the solution as distinct from ontologies of the problem domain. So it was interesting how the case studies draw out those different things that are modeled. We had terminology based, you know, whether you call it models of words or, you know, we had the focus on words rather than concepts. And we also had, as I mentioned just now, business rules, which sit very nicely alongside ontology. So I think that's almost, those are the main things I wanted to bring out. We're sort of short of time, but when we come onto the metrics side of things later on, we've basically covered, I've just gone through the metrics stuff and put it on a slide to look at what are the things that we've found. So we found these various benefits, customer retention, competitive advantage, speeding up time to market with different applications, and some but not very many numeric metrics. People have tried something once and it took them years and it didn't work, then they tried it with an ontology and it took them months and it did, that kind of metric. So you'll see all of those later on in the with the track three. And again, I've just pulled out the track three types of value model and gone through against those with the case studies just to show how we believe that we've demonstrated value using those case studies for each of those kinds of thing. So yeah, I've really covered all this now, some basic common themes that we saw in the case studies. So I don't know, Mills, do you want to kind of wrap it up from there? And then we'll get some questions.
So, okay. So he's coming back against the basic structure. At the end of the slide deck, and we're going to be out of time here. So I'm just going to highlight a couple things here. These because they kind of had to do with the mobilization. But what you'll find here is like, who's the company or the provider of it. And then there'll be a kind of a title for the case example, and then one or two sentences that kind of talk about what was done, what was valuable in it. And there's a more detailed summarization that you'll find in the wiki, that Mike put together in the wiki. So, but I wanted to kind of call attention. These three are well within the can be applied a lot of different ways. Today, connotate is another one, and then we're getting into more mainstreams, and you'll see, again, we have each of these where you see an A and a B, as in next interview, because the source was actually gave us two sub case studies as part of their presentation. And let's see if there's anything else that here. The Recognos financial, you'll see there's a number in the summary table at the beginning. It sort of referred to the presentation that I gave, that it just sort of said Siri. There were actually, seven or eight case examples that are part of that. That each one was done in a summary slide, and so we included them here as well. And so that's our gang, and from Apple to Z Agile. So we picked out 20. Meanwhile, we were also considering a much larger number, and you'll see in the communique, there's some reference, to some other categories. And at 11:28.
Yes, we have time for maybe one question.
1 minute, 10 second question.
Look at that, Windburn, right? They just everybody.
Okay.
Too many cases and too little time.
An offer to the folks on the phone. 30 seconds.
Again, thank you.
Well, from track three, thank you for the work you did in organizing the material on your synthesis page. It made our work a lot easier.
Okay, you're welcome. Okay, everybody, thanks.
Thank you, folks.
We'll be available to talk at other times.
Okay, Todd, I think, are you folks ready? We're going to do the third track. Out of here. What?
Back there, all the top green.
Upper left.
Green. Oh, right there. I assume you got it in time.
Do you have slides? Don't see.
Hello, everyone. Rex, are you online? Rex?
Rex, maybe you're muted.
Give him a few seconds here. We've got NIST time to measure.
Yes, I was muted.
Ah, excellent. Thank you. Since this you're part of this too, I want you to be able to defend yourself if I make some comments or whatever.
Okay.
Well, thank you, everyone. Rex Brooks and myself worked on the value metrics, value models track for this effort. And I first have to apologize because I don't think I put enough time into this properly. And you'll see some of the results here under, you know, the title here is completeness. Now, both Rex and I are sort of stressed for time, so sorry. But as Nicola pointed out, this is a volunteer effort for the most part, and I think we did a pretty good job overall. And the community and the whole world will get some value out of this. So, oh, I have to do this, don't I? Damn. Here we go. So, I'm just going to go through a quick reprise of what we talked about at the synthesis discussion, and then some new things to address this issue of completeness. And the issue really is, or the problem was, that wasn't complete, and perhaps never will be, however. So, what do we say? So, our goal was to look at the value models and what's important to stakeholders. And I have to point out, our initial view of this, and we talked about this during the synthesis meeting, oops, microphone. Our view came from a too technical perspective. And for many of the people in this room, we all sort of have that same bias, unfortunately. And why do I say it's unfortunate? Because the people who have the money are usually not the technologists. Now, sometimes they are, but I think they're in a small minority. Subsequently, the perspective you have to take has to address your audience, right? And in the context of trying to promote and sell the use of ontologies, your audience usually are the people that really don't care about ontologies, if they can pronounce the word. They don't want to hear it. They have problems that they have to have solved. They want to have solved, whatever it is, whether it's acquisition, whether it's knowledge management, whether it's integration, or customer satisfaction. Those are the problems that they're concerned about. Those are the problems that they're going to be measured on and paid by or paid for, whatever. So our initial view of what the metric should be was primarily based on a software background. And there are lots of metrics and very well defined methodology for that. However, I want to now come back and say, well, we weren't exactly wrong. And why weren't we exactly wrong? Well, as was pointed out by Michael and by Mills and Michael, that there are many dimensions to this problem space. And I do call it a problem space. If you're familiar with phase spaces, okay, same notion. It's a very good analogy. So there's a lot of dimensions here. And one of the incompletenesses that we failed to address was the life cycle model. For this summit, the real part of the life cycle that we should be focusing on is the acquisition phase. People want to buy the stuff. They want to get something to solve their problem. Later on, when you get to the development phases and the operation and maintenance phases, those have separate metrics and separate concerns, and more importantly, separate stakeholders that are going to be interested in those responsibilities. So we did look at the formal ROIs, and there are none. Now, one of the things that we didn't address properly, though some of it was brought up by both Mills and Michael, was these qualitative intangibles. So, since they're intangible, it's kind of hard to put a metric on it, but I'm sure we can get a grant from NIST to work on that. But what are some of those intangibles? Well, as was pointed out, if you try and get a group of people together that are not ontologists, that may not even be software people, they're business people, they have their processes to abide by and use, you get them together and help them develop or formalize their processes, that process of communicating among the group to make explicit that what many people had been working on implicitly or semi-consciously is itself a very huge value. And to date, for the most part, that's sort of intangible. If you work with any large group trying to divine the scope of a problem, you'll find that everyone has their own opinions, their own assumptions, their own internal implicit ontology, and you have to sort of extract it to make it explicit. So one of the values of ontologies, of course you don't want to use that word, is that it will make certain knowledge that had been implicit explicit. And it's not the categorization nonsense. And I am trying to promote the notion of anti-categorical thinking. One of the benefits of formalizing the knowledge, whatever it might be, is that in addition to the usual taxonomy nonsense, you want to bring out the relationships. And it's the relationships that are going to make things or break things for you when you start to use this stuff. Any categories, well, whatever. But it's the relationships among those things, especially when you get into process modeling. So there are no good metrics for that at this point. And now I've gone on. So let's get down to the things that were overlooked, and it's down here. One of the obvious things, and this is really embarrassing, is that we did not explicitly address the environment of the problems that were to be solved and the environment in which the ontologies were going to be used. Now, this is why I said to you, Michael, sort of embarrassed me a bit. Michael did bring up some of the environment part. How big is it? How big is the problem or the problem space that you're trying to address with your stakeholder now, the person who has the money? How big is that space? And let me go on to that. Now, the other issue is the life cycle, which I brought up. These were not addressed explicitly. They were addressed sort of a little bit by some of the other tracks. So what's the scope of the problem you're going to address, and what life cycle stage of the stakeholder is interested? Will be interested in? Oh, got to get the right button here. Okay, well, these are the value models that we identified from the case studies. So let me go on from there. We saw all these already. Business efficiency, business agility, operational efficiency, customer satisfaction, IT efficiency. There's probably others here, but these are broad categories. And again, these are looking at the business problem because you're usually talking to business people to get the initial money. Later on in the life cycle, you're going to be talking to other people. If it's your CTO or CIO, or if you go lower down to system administrators, they have different interests, and hence different metrics that they were going to use, and their value models are going to be different. So there's a range of value models depending on your stakeholder. And of course, that's one dimension. The other dimension is the particular business problem or business space that you're working in. That's going to be other dimensions. So this is a multidimensional space. Subsequently, trying to come up with simple value models and simple metrics that are going to fit everything is just a lost cause, and we recognize that. Okay, so some of the metrics, again, the metrics are going to change depending on what the, I keep looking at the wrong place here, depending on what the particular value model is. We recognized, first of all, that none of the case examples that were given really clearly identified any particular metrics to show their value, though many of them were sort of implicit. And subsequently, we could not then say, well, you know, if you're going to do business agility, here's the one metric that'll do it all. You can integrate five huge corporations in 2 months and everything will be happy. Not obvious at all, if it's possible. Okay, so what we did provide to the communique writers, and they summarized it a little differently, was this paradigm to develop what the value models and value metrics should be. So I'll put it up here, but you can read it later. One is to characterize this business problem or the operational problem that you're working in or need to address, whether it's one of these things or something similar. Who are the stakeholders? And again, the stakeholders and the life cycle, they are related, certainly. You have to figure out where you are in that. You want to probably then, in terms of trying to talk to the people in terminology that they are going to appreciate and understand, identify which of the categories from the framework are most appropriate. And of course, as Michael said, there are variations of that, and they're not mutually orthogonal. Then you have to identify the strategy, and we'll hear about strategies in a little bit. Once you've gotten those things identified, you should be able to make it clear what the value models and the particular metrics are. Oh, thank you. What the particular metrics are that you need. For people on the phone, if I keep wandering away, just make some noise and I'll come back. So we identified this as at least a paradigm, if nothing else. Can't give you exact metrics, but hopefully this should help you figure out what you need to do to sell to the people that you're talking to. Now, some of the things that were overlooked, the life cycle factors. This relates to the stakeholders I mentioned earlier. So our initial value models and metrics, as I said, were based on our bias and our knowledge and history and experience, design time. You know, when you design these things, what metrics do you want to use? Lines of ontologies, number of relations, number of concepts, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's nice to know, but that really may not have a direct interest to the CIO unless you can relate those number of concepts and relations and whatever rules to a particular cost factor. It's going to take me 2 months to develop 5 terms and 60 relations. That could be a value. They don't care about the number of terms or relations or rules, but how much is it going to cost? How much time is it going to take? At some point, they might want to drill down to those very specific things, but initially, probably not. So we did come to these realizations in our synthesis that we really need to focus on that acquisition phase, the whole beginning of the life cycle, as I said. But again, that depends on stakeholders. You may have a range of stakeholders in your room, and you may have to address all of them to some extent. But primarily, you want to focus on the people who are going to say yes, no, go ahead and do it, or don't do it. There are no few models or metrics that are going to work for everything. You're going to have to specialize, unfortunately. And there are different values and models for metrics and models for the different life cycle phases. And, of course, they're related. Which ones you have to bring out when, you're going to have to figure out. And hopefully our paradigm will help. So here's another overlooked factor, the environment, as I said earlier. Where does your problem space live? Are you doing something all for the entire European Union? Are you doing something just for Ireland? Are you doing something for the internet? So there are different scales involved. And each of those scales entails some scope. You know, and here's just some simple metrics or some simple ranges of scales. You know, this is network scaling. Here's organizational scaling. Here's financial scaling. So there's all sorts of scales for the problem space that you need to address with your stakeholder or stakeholders. And you have to figure out which ones it should be. And I admit that we just didn't think about this at all. Or didn't think about it sufficiently. So if you're going to do something for the entire internet using ontologies, whoa, you've got a challenge there. Mills, did you have a question?
No, I mean, I could comment for hours. But no.
Yeah, okay. Well, if it's very pithy or amusing, feel free to jump in. I'm talking very quickly, so we'll get to lunch earlier. So again, it's a scale issue. We didn't really address that directly. The other one, again, the operational environment, and that impacts the scope of the things that you want to consider as possible solutions, and then hence the value they'll have, and then the models and the metrics used for those value models. I'm repeating myself. Okay, so a couple of things we missed. The life cycle, where are you, and the operational scope. How big a thing is it you are looking at? Now, another issue with operational scope has to do, in addition to the technical issues, it's the human issues. People may not be especially interested in learning about ontologies or using them or whatever. You know, they just want the damn thing to work, right? However, there are a group of people that do. So one of the issues in trying to sell your solution is, depending again on the particular problem space and what you are claiming you'll be able to provide by your solution, are impacts on people. So if people have to understand the use of the ontology and some of the intricacies of the rules behind where they're being used, you're probably going to lose some traction real fast. I've certainly run into situations myself where I propose a solution, and perhaps it was geared too technically oriented, and people come back and say, oh, well, you know, I don't want to learn that, or that's going to be so bloody hard, or blah, 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 blah. You know, they don't know anything about it, but they think it's going to be difficult straight away. So one of the problems in the value models and value metrics is the human side. And you can talk about this as human-machine interaction if you want. But there is that aspect that needs to be accounted for when you're looking at your value models and creating your pitch. Yes, I'm going to save you $2 million in your integration effort, but the people that get stuck with my result are really going to hate it, and your productivity is going to go down the hill for about 6 months before they accept it and get with it. So that becomes then part of the value proposition. Yes, I can do miracle things. No one's going to use it. Great. We've been through that enough. Okay. Interoperability. Now, that term does show up. In fact, that's perhaps one of the best catchphrases you want to use if you're pitching this stuff. Certainly, if you have an ontology, you have a better chance of interoperability than without it. However, as along with any other technology, you can do really bad things with it, and it could be absolutely useless. You know, if you go and try and pitch a solution today based on ontologies and other sophisticated reasoning capabilities, people may come back and say, well, I can use a relational database. I got lots of experts in the background. I can do the same thing. Yeah, it's going to take a little longer, but I can get the job done. Okay, so what is doing using the ontologies help you with? Well, certainly if it's done properly, and again, as Amanda brought out, you may not get a good ontology, depending on who you bring in. You can still end up with something that's inoperable, you will not have any interoperability. Now, the other issue is, what did I write here? Oh, yes, here. Very important thing, this item here about this nonlinearity. The more you try and be interoperable, that is, the larger the scope that you're addressing, I'm sorry, my brain slipped a gear. I should read this backwards. If your operational environment is very large, then your interoperability needs are going to go up nonlinearly. So again, depending on the scope, perhaps the ontologies are the only really reasonable solution, and that's a point you want to stress. How interoperable does your solution to the problem have to be? Again, are you working on a small scale, a large scale, a humongous scale, interplanetary? And in fact, don't dismiss interplanetary because there are concerns there already, and they'll start to show up more. But no. Okay, so of course, interoperability requires the commonality of the terminology and the semantics that are used. And of course, the scope of the interoperability is going to drive what you need to have common. So then commonality, operational environment is going to drive what needs to be common. Okay, so hence, you know, by inference there, transitivity, you're going to get this nonlinearity of the commonality issue coming up again. And then, again, whether you're using the ontologies for development or for runtime or for maintenance issues, that's going to decide what you need to do or not do. And then finally, pretty perhaps trite, but might as well be said, they're going to facilitate commonality and interoperability. And interoperability might be the real good buzzword to use. And the value solutions that are going to facilitate that are going to be dependent on the scope and the scale of what you're trying to address. Now, that might be patently obvious, but I think it really needs to be made explicit. What is it you're addressing? How big is that thing? Because that's going to impact how you're going to sell it and perhaps the value that you could bring or might bring to it. And again, the value metrics and models are going to vary with the operational scope and scale. And hence, the larger the scope or the scale, the larger the value of using ontologies. And that's another theme that you can sell. Now, another issue that comes in here in terms of interoperability is extensibility. How dynamic do you have to be? If you really have to be dynamic, then you probably want to use ontologies, but again, you can screw that up also. If you need to be changing or being very agile in your business, you have to add new business lines, new products. Your customer satisfaction has to be changed quickly because your customer base is shifting or it's growing greatly. Then you want to have some agility, and hence you really want to have common terminology and ontology under the hood so that you can do all of that for your IT systems. And with that, I have a lot of time left for questions. Oh, Rex.
Yes.
I'd like you to say a few words about all the work you've done on the matrix that's now currently on the synthesis page.
I put the URL in the chat, but we gathered together all 24 use cases and case studies and put them in one place to compare the problem, the solution, the metrics, and the value. The added value or the value model and the value proposition. So it makes it easier to find them and compare them. And you can get that, as I said, either on the page, the value synthesis page, or track three synthesis page for values, and you can get it through the URL that's on the chat. And I'm worried about that. It doesn't contain the A or B from case studies because I wasn't aware of that and I didn't get that information. And there were two more use cases that were offered yesterday in email that may be added later. But otherwise, you've got a pretty complete set with 20 pages and 24 entries.
And if I could figure out how to type the URL in here quickly, I'd go to it. So are there any other questions? Michael on the left, my left. Michael Gruniger.
So in this last point here, it's kind of interesting, like the scope of interoperability. So if you're looking at, say, the number of translators you need to write, right, it's you know, without, for point to point, it's n squared minus n, and for a single ontology would be 2n. Well, actually, if you only have two applications, it's worse to use an ontology. And it's not until you get five applications that you can really see a significant, five applications before you get significant savings. So how do you, we need to kind of address.
Well, hold on. There's another aspect there. Okay, I only currently have two applications. How many might I have in the future? Or when do I expect to have to change those applications and at what rate?
Well, that's the issue that we need to address sometimes to convince management, companies, because if they're only looking at a quarter horizon or a year horizon, they say, well, we're only integrating two applications. So, you know, if they're only integrating two applications at a time, then we need to kind of convince them of that there's this longer term investment that, oh, you know, a few years down the road, it'll pay off. But in the short term, it's not going to pay off. You're going to have to sink, you know, a lot of money in. So I think that's one of our challenges is to.
Well, this gets back to the scope of the problem space that they're trying to address. If their problem space has, you know, is invariant, well, then, you know, you don't need to do it. But if it's not invariant, it's going to be changing, then that's where you want to address. It's going to be changing. You know it's going to change. So why not think about it up front before they're getting hit later?
Right, but they need to be able to be thinking those, like, more than a quarter ahead or more than a year ahead. It's
right, so that's our challenge to
demonstrate. Can I address this, too?
I'm sorry, go ahead, Rex.
I'd like to suggest that there's one other measurement that is very hard to put into dollars and cents, but it's actually quite significant. And that's the value of the cost for not having something when you need it. Because in the future, not only will you be able to do another one easier, it's much, much faster, and you can come online with it quicker. So it is something that it isn't simply better in the long run because it's cheaper. It's also faster.
That's the scare factor. Amanda?
Overlapping comment, but I what struck me just before the question started looking at the slides is that it's important to realize the scope and scale aren't just a matter of how big or numerous or diverse a community you're talking to, but also the temporal scope and scale. And that's really a big part of what we're talking about here is if this is supposed to last into the future, right, it's becomes much easier to make the case because you've got interoperating over different communities, even with your single application in that case.
The scope has multiple dimensions. Matthew?
Most large organizations are already in the position where they have an awful lot of spaghetti interfaces, and they have noticed how expensive they are to maintain. That's not the problem. The problem is that is where they are, and now how do they move, and how do you persuade them to move to an environment that is more soundly based and which will be cheaper to maintain? Because even though when they make a change to an application, there may be some large number of interfaces that needs to be adjusted as a result, each individual thing is still not enough to justify the whole investment of an ontology, but they will be able to see why it is that it's costing them so much to do the maintenance. So that you may be getting to the point where you can see from the ongoing work why there's a business case for doing things a better way.
Nicola?
I would like to comment on the point you made on the fact that the environment and life cycle are neglected somehow, and they seem to be an obvious aspect to take into account. Indeed, I'd like to stress this point. Doing real ontologies for business definitely requires taking this outer environment into account, which is basically a socio-technical system. So you have to model the interactions between people and machines and not just the machines themselves. And also the value model itself needs to be modeled. And this is the challenge right now. This is not something we have, I believe, good ontologies which properly account for larger socio-technical systems and for value models. And this is something we need, I guess.
Yeah. Simon?
I was just going to say, getting back to the two applications are not enough, and just speaking from painful personal experience that encouraged me to move back out of university administration and go back and get my doctorates. When you have two applications in a university environment where there is no understanding or common agreement of what the concept of a student is, when you have concepts that are that fundamental to the two applications, where there are two completely different kinds of understanding, then any sort of formalization and well, it's hard to get agreement and work out that you've actually agreed with anything short of an ontology, but or short of something roughly equivalent. But when it's that critical, even two is enough.
But Simon, what you might be talking about is a sociological issue, and there's no financial consequences for them screwing up. So there might be other solutions than developing an ontology, though certainly having them develop that would solve it.
Well, I'm paying now for the for them screwing up.
Okay. Oh, Ravi, you have a question?
Yes, I do. I typed it also. What factors relating to environment increase non-linearly the requirements for ontology interoperability?
Interoperability. If your system or whatever you're going to use your ontology with has to be interoperable with N systems, and you weren't going to use ontologies, and as Michael gave you the arithmetic earlier, it's non-linear, it's at least square.
Just the number of connections that you are expecting simultaneously. But based on variety and type of ontology integration, does it have to non-linearly increase?
It may.
Probably not.
It may.
Yeah.
Michael, I'm sorry, Ravi, you had
so
more?
The only factor I saw there was the bandwidth requirement in your definition of the environment.
Well, the bandwidth The bandwidth may also be variable if you have dynamic provisioning, and your ontology can very well optimize that and give you significant increases in performance.
Michael Oshold?
Non-linear is related only to number of simultaneous ontology interconnections that you require.
No, Ravi, I was being intentionally vague. I didn't want to get into the issues of exactly what type of nonlinearity and or how are we going to go about calculating it. So that itself has multiple dimensions. So we have to move on. I'm sorry, Ravi. If you could put further questions in the chat box, we'll let Rex get back to you.
I did.
Sorry,
hi.
Rex. Michael.
Hi.
So I really I like the fact that you kind of what percolated up out of your effort was interoperability. It's certainly one that I've seen over the years over and over again. Yeah. And another one is that you mentioned was the kind of the business agility. But I didn't see from your presentation that it percolated up to have equal or prominent significance as, say, the interoperability does. And I think it does have that degree of prominence. It almost always seems to be behind the benefits of ontology application.
Well, there's a lot of entailments among many of these notions, which we didn't address at all. So if you're very interoperable, then I think it necessarily follows that you will have the agility you need because you're already interoperable. You don't have to rebuild things. I could do stuff because blah, blah, blah. So.
Yeah,
or at least it reduces some of the cost. Mills.
I sort of feel you've given short shrift to what's happening in consumer markets and what's happening in social computing. For example, we don't have to worry about, if you're looking at it from enterprise thing, then you know they're hunkered down about their costs. But in the case of the Siri example, or you look at everything else that's going on, the value proposition of being able to connect different information together is greater than aggregation. We figured that out. That's why linked data is happening. But if you look at it from a services, if you have recombinant services, then the value proposition of being able to connect services together to create new, in essence, molecules of value is huge. And so it's not just about saving yourself costs. It's really about enabling new categories of capability. And this is much more, this always trumps you know, the cost argument. No, I'm talking about from the consumer side. If you generate a consumer experience, they beat a path to your door. And ontologists should, like, also have this in their minds. That's why I'm stressing it to you now.
Well, you just brought out another part of the proposition that you want to put forward. If the solution you're going to provide is going to facilitate some of the social interaction, that's the business thrust to the people you're addressing, then yes, you have to bring that out. And no, you're right, we didn't bring that part up at all. You'll note the title is completeness with a question mark, i.e. it's not complete.
So, it's not a critique, I just want to stress the point.
No, but I wanted to bring out there are these other things that we just haven't thought about. Our viewpoints are biased, and it's being represented here, and we have to get slapped upside the head to recognize there's other things we have to do. Okay, just one more, Leo. Leo's going to mug me in a moment. Pat, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. I'm not sure if you have it in there somewhere. One of the things that cross-database interoperability enables is cross-database consistency checking. You say data integrity checking. Of course, you can do data integrity checking by entering data into a single database. That's currently done. But if your databases aren't merged and interoperable, you can't do cross-database checking. And when you have mission-critical applications, having more accurate information can be very useful.
Okay, folks, we have to get started on the next track. Thank you. These questions are useful. We'll have to continue them later. Thank you.
Thank you.
The fourth track we'll now present. This is Strategies for Making the Case. Matthew West, Peter Yim.
Oh, wow, that was snazzy.
Page up, page down.
Yeah, no. I'm Matthew West. This is Peter Yim. The way that we're going to cock some boxes that I will start and he will finish. We were looking at strategies, so a fairly thin view across the top. So you're going to notice a lot of stuff that's turned up in other streams. And indeed, I think it's quite noticeable that there are recurring themes through the work that all the tracks have done. I think that's a good thing. I think what's good is the way that that's shown a lot of consistency and a lot of people listening to what's going on in other tracks. Okay. One of the first things that we concluded in the strategy area is that there is no commercial case for ontology on itself. It is not an end in itself. It is not. You are no richer for having an ontology, and pile more ontology up in the corner of the room, and you won't be able to sell it. It's a tool. It's how you use it that gives value. Some of the problems that you can have there, where it can be used, is interoperability. We've talked about, and also things like legacy modernization. And one of the things that's also difficult is that ontology is, in some respects, a solution to a wide range of problems. So trying to say just that ontology is good is a little bit like saying apple pie is good. You need to actually point it at a particular problem, and it's that overall solution, is that particular solution that includes an ontology, which is what you can sell. My background, at least, is in, this is one of my slides from one of the original presentations, and my background is from some 30 years in Shell, and at least 20 of those years trying to make better use of information in the corporate environment. So this is one of the slides that I've used in the way that, how do you incorporate ontology in a way that it does deliver value? So where does the value actually come from? And the value actually comes from the decisions that are made in the organization. You get good decisions made, and the organization performs better. You get bad decisions made, it gets and the enterprise goes down. And what is it you need to make good decisions? It's good information. If you have good quality information that's accurate, timely, complete, and a whole load of other stuff, it's really quite hard to make bad decisions, actually.
There are a few people who much prefer not to have good information because they actually like taking decisions by the seat of their pants, but that's actually a dying breed these days. Most people are too scared of taking any responsibility these days when there isn't adequate information, and if they don't have adequate information, they will just defer the decision, even if any decision would be better than none. So that's about information. So if information is what you need, how do ontologists support giving you information? Well, of course, in some cases, they give it directly through reasoning. They actually give you the answers to the questions that you're asking. In other ways, they provide semantics, common semantics that supports the use of information. And this is where we were talking about integration and things like this, using a common terminology and a common ontology of your domain enables you to integrate across various applications, amongst other things. So those are that's how it actually happens. And actually, it's interesting. If you actually want to go and find a place where you could apply ontologies, look for somewhere where there have been some very bad decisions made. Then find out why that was a problem with information. And then find out why an ontology would have helped to improve that. The only thing I can assure you of is that people won't think it's an information problem or an ontology problem. It's too many steps away. They will be running around thinking about other things that were important. So, for instance, take the Macondo well, the BP problem in the Gulf. It's not hard to see that someone made a decision that bet the company. And the only person who had the right to do that would have been the CEO, and he sure as heck wasn't the person taking the decisions. So you can be quite certain that there was an information problem there. And in fact, if you start digging through what was going on there, you can see lots of information problems there. Okay. So, two types of business case. Incremental, so doing the same thing better, we would say that. Data integration is a good example. We've already talked about that, so I'm not going to dwell too much on it here. But also there are disruptive things. Enabling something completely new, and we have the Siri example as one of the case studies that does that. And notice here that it wasn't the ontology that was the objective, but it was what you were doing with it that was the objective. We also came across some key strategic areas, some things where you can look for and follow and give you some idea of where you can pick things up. So there were three data trails. The volume trail, where is there lots of information? If there's lots of information, it's going to need managing, it's going to need integrating. What's growing fastest? Go and look for that. Value trail, where's the money? That's in the decisions, remember. And the integration trail, where do data flows need to interface? And how can you make that better with ontologies? Well, I thought we ought to have at least one decent bullshit diagram. Oh no, sorry, this is an ontology. Now I look at it more carefully. It's sort of a little bit of owl diagram. Sort of. The thick lines are subtype lines if you're trying to read it. The other lines actually have names on them. So this is how ontology gets used in information systems. That's what this is trying to show. And I'm going to start at the top left there. And we've got terminologies. This is what one of my friends calls the list of famous names. And remembering that a terminology is not a dictionary. A dictionary is about how terms get used. A terminology is a particular choice of terms for a particular use. An ontology tells you the rules about things that are in a terminology. And my favorite definition of an ontology, the things that exist and the rules that govern them. And then there are some things around the place which are ontologies in your enterprise, and indeed across enterprises for that matter. So a direct type of ontology is a process model. All good enterprises will know what their business process model is, which is down on the bottom right-hand corner. And then, of course, you have the application process models, which is what particular applications support. And then there are some other sorts of ontology as well that are around the place. You'll have a conceptual model or conceptual data model, depending on how your people are talking about it. that's a model of the thing, largely of the things in the enterprise. And then you have of the types of things in the enterprise, and then you have the master and reference data, roughly in the middle of the diagram there, which is very much the ontology of the enterprise in terms of its products, its organization, its geography, locations, properties, and a whole range of other stuff that gets used throughout the enterprise. And then we have some data models. There's the integration, and the thing that characterizes, let's start with the application data model, because this is the one that's most typical. An application logical and physical data model is a model of the data that is required by an application so that it can function properly. Certain data will be mandated, and remember that the data is needed for the decisions that are being made in that application. So in your processes, there are certain decision points, places where the process can branch, and there is where you need the information so that you can make those decisions. And they come together, the application data model and the application process model come together in the application itself. So the data model is used by the application, and the application process model, again, is executed by it. Sorry? Okay, someone coughing. So if those are if that's the application data model, just above it, we have an integration data model. And an integration data model is much looser than an application data model in the sense that it's much less constrained. Remember, an application model is what you need for a particular application. An integration model is what you need across a range of them. So they tend to be much more permissive. It's about what you may say. Examples of integration models are things like in business information, business intelligence types applications, where you're trying to bring together data from a wide range of information systems so that you can slice and dice that data. And then again, you have exchange data models, which is about getting data from one application to another. And again, this is going to be related to what you have in the different sorts of systems. Notice that the master and reference data is used in all of those different sorts of data model. And it's the common language, which means that what goes on amongst those actually is the same. It means that the integration, the data model is of the things in the concept, it's the data about the things in the conceptual data model. So if the conceptual data model is, if you like, a fairly high-level ontology of your enterprise, then your integration data model is the data you hold about those things. You have a thing in your ontology, in your conceptual data model, and you have the data about that thing in your application data model or your integration data model that you hold. Yep. Okay, I think I've gone around that. Yeah, the key thing here is the difference between ontology and a data model, where a data model is the relationships and data that may or must be held about something. And an ontology is the thing itself. Pathithra?
Yes. Where does the rules fit?
The rules are in the ontology. So anything that's an ontology has some rules in it.
About the relationship.
About?
In business work or in business requirements, when we do.
Can you get a mic?
It was.
The ontology, does that include the business rules?
Yes.
all of that, not the relationship.
Anything that's an ontology, and so that means all the subtypes, will include some types of things and some rules about those things. Otherwise, I think we would argue it's not an ontology. It would, for instance, be a terminology. Okay? So that's what it means to be an ontology here. Okay. So here's another diagram about how ontology supports data information. And in particular, here we're looking at data. And so you have your enterprise data model, which supports the clarity of information and defines its meaning. You have consistency, again, which is something the enterprise data model does by providing a common framework across the enterprise. You have physical data models, the master and reference data that I was talking about on the previous thing, an integration architecture, interface operations, which is where ontologies can be used to do the translation between between different views of things. Your automated processes can use ontologies to provide information in a more timely way. And actually, one of the simple things you can do with ontology actually is check the quality of information. What is it it's supposed to have? What's supposed to be there? You can just do simple checks using ontology tools just to check the quality, that it's what it should be. Okay, we talked a bit about master data management. It's a particular area where ontologies can play a key role. You saw that master data management was pretty much at the center of that bullshit diagram I had. And managing your master data is those methods and tools that help us to manage the structured and unstructured data. So it provides you with that common language. And actually how you do that management is quite critical. It's actually a real opportunity for ontology, because one of the things about master data is just how interconnected it is. It's got lots of relationships, actually to make that happen in a relational environment is really quite difficult. I've seen lots of tools that claim to be master data management tools, and I haven't yet seen one that it looks any good. And that's because of the way that the way those tools are designed. They're designed on essentially a flat file, you mean you wanted to change that sometimes? You wanted to update it? You mean this stuff can change? Oh gosh, didn't know that. And they just can't do it. So you only end up with the current state, and then you end up without being able to see how things have evolved over time. And that does happen. Okay. So, one of the things that's interesting is this thing about, can you afford to do something like master data management? And it's right, we were talking earlier about integration, you know, can you afford not to do it? The only thing that's worse than the cost of doing master data management are the costs of not doing master data management, I think it's fair to say. But this is a real opportunity for us to actually make a difference in organizations of any significant size. One of the other things that we came across was about recognizing different audiences. Because you don't need to make the same case to each of them. And what we have here is a list of the audiences that we've identified and something about the perspective that they will have on what we're doing. So policymakers, convincing them that this is the strategic way to go. Budget holders, we need to talk to them to get the work funded. Technology decision makers, convincing them that this is the approach, usually that it's technologically sound, that it's sufficiently mature that it can actually be applied. Technology implementers, the users and consumers of the technology, That's about trust and buzz, that they're actually going to ask about it. You know, is there an ontology inside this? Educators produce the people who both have the skills to do it, but also the skills to appreciate it. And for each of these, we will need to have some different tales to tell. And it's now time to hand over to Peter.
Thank you, Matthew. It was a great opportunity to work with Matthew, and I really enjoyed the things we did on our track. We actually started out trying to start a debate, and Steve even helped us invite Clay Shirky, who wrote "Ontologies Are Overrated," but Clay declined our invitation. So we ended up, asking the community for sound bites and elevator pitches and so on. And I think the collection really helped. So most of this summit, actually, the last 3 months and even today, we are going to work on pragmatics. And I think each of the track has covered that very well. So I asked Matthew, maybe I can have 2 slides to talk about things we don't want to talk about. And that's the lower part, second bullet on this slide, which says, that's the visionary side of things. The fact that we're not talking about it doesn't mean it's not important, but it's just we can't go into the details here. Or even if we go in there, it's probably slightly not scientific enough for this community, but it's important. So it's the decisions that JFK made to go to the moon. So it may or may not be a rational decision, but it's important. Otherwise we wouldn't have NASA, we wouldn't have a lot of technologies we have at hand. And John Sower reminded us that Steve Jobs don't do it this way, or at the beginning of the exercise in writing the communique, John said, this is difficult because that's not how Steve Jobs would get convinced. Sure, it's like the Steve Jobs and the bean counters situation. So, during our exercise, during the virtual sessions, track 4, we had several people, one of which is the Siri SRI vice president, who sort of helped facilitate the acquisition of Siri into Apple and so on. And I gave a few points, talked about a few points. I said, which was entitled Science and Technology that Changed the World, Beyond Good Work, Beyond Marketing Stunts, and Beyond Logic. And people would ask, why would we even talk beyond logic? And I think the answer is here. A lot of us, at least a portion of what we are trying to address, may be still at what Thomas Kuhn would call the pre-paradigm phase. And I remember a first conversation, of course, I had with George Strawn, and he said, back in those days, people like us, they burned at the stake. That's exactly it. And the real potentials that we are looking at, I sort of encapsulated in a soundbite saying, ontology promises to be the driver for the next paradigm shift. And if you think personal computing or the internet has been disruptive, wait till what ontology can bring about. I personally believe, that would be the level of thinking that is applicable to ontologies. And just this morning, as Steve mentioned earlier during breakfast, we said last year at the summit, we did a Delphi study, and the general conclusion that was drawn from the people who responded actually says ontology is about 5 or 10 years away. And we still think that that is on track. Although, of course, there's a whole spectrum, and there are certain things that are applicable now. There were certain things that should have been applied last year or 10 years ago that wasn't. But the main potentials will probably be playing itself out in the last the next 5 or 10 years. And I try to capture a piece of work that I co-authored back in 2006 when I was a research fellow at the Institute for the Future, which sort of looked at, I mean, what kind of technologies and science would stick. And it's way beyond good work. I mean, you have the best product in the world, best mousetrap, and it may not fly. And we came to these conclusions. The right people is involved. It feels a strong need. There's a tyranny in the installed base that needs to be overcome. We overcome like physical limits, technology limits of the day. Is the market ready? There's a technology capacity issue. I mean, you can do things that require huge bandwidth or huge CPU cycles when you only have like machines that work with like 100 megahertz or per second or something. Timing, global social and economic trends. So all these things fall in place. I mean, these are not what we're talking about, but if we want ontology to stick, maybe we need a little bit of luck. Not so much whether we have our science correct, but then we hope all these things line up properly so that we can launch ontology correctly. And Matthew did a great job putting a synopsis into the synthesis page, and there we have pointers to all the collected community input, which is really wonderful. And we want to, in closing, quote Nicola, who said, "An ontology is like a contract's fine print, one of those things which require a very precise technical jargon, which you might ignore in many cases, but which can save your business in critical situations." So with that, maybe we have 3 minutes.
Some questions?
There are two simple concepts about ontologies I've heard in the last couple of weeks that I've yet to hear expressed here. The first came when the European Commission presented to the Ontolog Forum a couple weeks ago, and they summed up their experience, and I've lost it now, but in the chat log, Steve Ray said, good quote, "The need comes first, ontologies come later." That seemed to summarize the European Commission-funded research. The other came last week from Barry Smith at this ontology meeting in support of the FAA's Next Gen program, which I think this represents the two largest government-funded programs with ontology. Last week, Barry Smith said, "The problem with too many ontologies now is that we have semantic silos. We really only need one ontology for each application. We can't afford more." So basically, those are two simple concepts that I think need to be addressed. I've yet to hear them here. The first deals with the sequencing of where does ontology come into the larger problem of information management. The second is with regard to the number and scale of ontologies that are brought to bear here.
I think that's what we said here. The first point, Brand, I think is what we were saying here on our first slide. The other one is about standardization. You do see standard ontologies turning up in a number of places. Certainly, Barry is doing quite a lot in the biomedical area.
But we've got Mike Bennett sat over there doing work on standard ontologies in the finance area. I've done work on that in the process industries area. So those things are around. I agree not talked about much here. Yep.
Yeah, maybe we might need to paraphrase Barry a little. It's not that we need one ontology, but rather we need ontology that can talk to each other. Well, and interoperate.
He was saying, what I heard was one per domain. Yes. But
yeah.
He was saying just one.
Yes.
Oh, one for everything.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Then we'll need to take him on elsewhere, not today.
Amanda.
Amanda Weissman here. Barry was, in fact, arguing for one ontology per domain, but please note, Barry was arguing that to the people who are working these various large real-world implementations, not from them. And that is not a view that has a lot of purchase as in the particular frame that he put it in those worlds. There is a lot of talk about domain-specific or user community-specific ontologies, standardization at that level, and then integration. But that's different from the kind of thing that Barry was arguing.
There's actually a natural process. One of my old boss used to have something that he called the innovation funnel, which is you start off at the top of this funnel with a whole heap of good ideas, and eventually these sift and sort into two or three things that actually make the grade. And eventually you get just one or two that just become part of the environment without noticing. That's just a natural process. You can neither force it nor prevent it.
If I can just follow quickly, Beth Huffer, who works on the FAA Next Gen project, made a comment at that conference that the value of ontologies for semantic interoperability in that kind of environment is in integrating the different ontologies, not in enforcing the single one top down.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, folks, so we're going to adjourn. Fabian is self-enforcing the Fabian rule. We're going to adjourn for lunch now and reconvene at 1:45. I mean, is that right? Pardon? Oh, yes. Ram. Ram, can we keep computers in here? Is it safe?
It should be safe, but I think one thing you can do is lock up the room and try to get someone to open it 5 minutes early. I think you can lock it, so let me... Pardon?
Yeah, I mean, maybe folks will come back to their machines or something.
Yeah.
Some people are going to drift back into their email.
Yeah, so you can leave it like this, and I'm not sure. This is generally safe.
Okay, so folks, we think you can...
This kind of thing, but someone can stay here maybe, probably. I will try...
We think you can leave your computers here, but if you feel uncertain, take them to lunch. This is fairly secure, but it's still open, yes.
Can I try accessing a browser in here? Can I get that slide back to the browser?
Sure. What do you need then? Is that what they had up?
Well, whatever the browser was, I just wanted to see if I can access the
Yes, so you should be able to.
You can keep your computers here. Someone will be here all the time.
Oh.
So you can keep your computers here. You can leave your computers here and go for lunch.